You're listening to the Looseheads podcast. Join the movement.
Let's get people talking about mental health.
And together we will tackle the stigma. This is the Looseheads podcast.
Hello there and welcome back to the latest Looseheads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union with me, Chris Hill. And I have to say, Series 3, which is what I'm calling it, has been really positive and really enjoyable so far. And some of the comments we've received from you guys, the listeners, has been really good. I mean, from the Nolly Waterman podcast and the Liam Sopawanga podcast we've done so far this year, some of the comments have been great. So we really appreciate your support. And don't forget to review the podcast as well, because that's massively important to us. So thank you so much for taking the time to listen once again. And Free People, which are, of course, massively important to this podcast, to Rob, Mark and Dave, and the trio are constantly busy working on new ways to keep spreading the awareness and mental health. And Rob, just to start with you, mate, it's no different for you guys over the last couple of weeks, is it?
Yeah, so today we've sort of started up the Really campaign, which is all about the ask twice concept and checking in on your mates. You know, asking a friend how they are and then asking again, how are you, really? Hopefully we can build a bit of momentum with it and people are checking in with their close support networks.
Yeah, and I know in the Instagram message, Rob, that you put out this morning on your social media, you say it's more important than ever really now to just check in on your friends and family and whoever you are closest to or whoever that may be. So just checking in to see if they're okay, because it's crucial we keep talking about mental health and keep spreading that awareness, as Rob mentioned there. And it's exactly what we aim to do on this podcast every week, to bring you an episode to keep talking about mental health. And we're absolutely delighted to say joining us on the Looseheads podcast today is former Northampton State and England under 20 international Tom Stevenson. So Tom, thanks so much for joining us on the pod and welcome to the Looseheads podcast. First things first, how's things with you?
Yeah, all good, thanks, and thanks for having me. You find me in Paddington in the office on my lunch break, so life's a bit different now, wearing a shirt and jumper to work rather than the rugby boots and some shorts, but no, it's all well. Day's going good so far.
Are you travelling to Paddington on a moped, I believe, or is that?
Yeah, I mean, I am this week. Now it's got a bit warmer. Last week, it was a bit too cold at 6 a.m. in the morning to jump on the moped. Yeah, it was like the scene out of Dumber and Dumber when they arrived, wherever it is. I got it on this week, but no, it's a good way to get around London, a little bit different.
Definitely, Tom. Well, as I mentioned in the intro there, we've enjoyed some of the recent pods we've done, really, and they've really been focused on the importance of mental health. And of course, the reason why we do this podcast is to focus on aspects, but we've been able to tell stories and journeys people have been on really well over the last few weeks. And Tom's story has been told recently as well by Will Hooley for the Rugby Pass, as well as an article and an interview that was in the Daily Telegraph at the start of the year as well. And basically, Tom, we just wanted to begin by talking about sort of your transition out of rugby and sort of the struggles and the obstacles that you had to overcome because of some of the bad injuries you experienced during your career. So if you don't mind just telling us a little bit about that story, Tom, to begin with, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess it started about 4 or 5 years ago, the actual, which is built up to kind of what happened in the summer and because of COVID. But basically, when I was playing for Northampton, I broke my leg quite badly in a preseason game. And previously, so that was my first game back from another injury after being out for 8 months. So overall, I was out for about 18 months, let's say, maybe a little bit longer. And that probably started my kind of mental health battle then. Without me even knowing, I started to drink a lot, started to basically on the outside coming across like a real happy, pretty crazy guy, just going out every weekend, making people laugh. But on the inside, I was probably crying quite a lot. I used to go back to my bedroom on a Monday and Tuesday and cry my eyes out. And no one saw that. It was just my kind of personal battle. And I was probably too young and naive and uneducated at the time to even realize I was going through mental health battles. And basically got back playing rugby, fast forward a year, and all forgotten about in my head. I was playing rugby again, doing the thing I loved, playing in front of, 10,000-15,000 people on the weekend, all forgotten about happy days. But can still continue to drink quite a lot, probably. And then ended up moving down to London Irish. Had a great first season there in the Championship. And then broke my leg again, end of that season. And I was out for about 7-8 months with that. But the main difference between that one and the first one for me was at the time I was in London and I had much more going on outside of rugby. I had a girlfriend. So all my focus, I didn't think about rugby. I was just, you know, with my ex-girlfriend the whole time, with my friends in London. So it didn't really go too many. I wasn't really resort to drinking then. I was too busy, you know, having a life outside of rugby. And then fast forward again, COVID came. And then I found out from London Irish I wasn't going to be kept on. Had a few things in the pipeline, but that all kind of fell through as soon as COVID happened. And that then was the point where I was like, you know, all the things which happened four years ago resurfaced and the feelings resurfaced, but 10 times worse because I bottled it all up and buried it and didn't talk about it or deal with it. So then, yeah, COVID happened. You know, let's fast forward to June, July. I started to realize, you know, I could be in a place here where I might not have any options, but didn't tell anyone, just told everyone, oh, you know what? I don't really want to play rugby anyway. I want to go to the city and get a job and earn loads of money. Like I saw all my mates doing, but probably didn't realize how hard it is. So yeah, then, you know, kept saying to my mates, yeah, I'll just get a job. Like it'd be fine. Like I don't really want to play rugby. I've fallen out of love rugby and all that kind of nonsense, which on the inside wasn't true at all. It was just a case I didn't have anything good enough to take, basically. And I never really wanted to, I'll be honest, I never really wanted to go play in the champ or anything like that, because I kind of wanted to start a career if that was the case. And then I started drinking a lot during July, August, every weekend, going out and just getting uncontrollably drunk during the day, then coming home and coming back to my ex-missus and just giving her absolute hell and giving myself hell on going on the floor, crying, saying ridiculous things. And that happened about 8 weekends in a row. And probably after the second or third weekend, my ex-missus was like, you know, you probably should go see someone, like, or like, you're not all right. But I would always just tell her, like, you know, shut up, I'm fine. Like, you know, like just complete denial. Like, what are you on about? Like, I'm fine. I just had a bad weekend, kind of thing. And then it happened, yeah, 7-8 weekends in a row. And she was like, no, you need to go see someone. So I basically told her I was going to go see someone. Didn't end up seeing someone, was in denial, like just like didn't want to believe it myself. I just thought, you know what I need to do? I need to get a job. That's the only way to do it, is I'll get a job and my life will be back to normal. It's like, you know, getting some normality back in, I'll get some routine back. That will sort all my issues. So I got a job. And then kind of six weeks to 2 months into the job, she kept going, my mum kept going, you know, you don't seem yourself, like you're there, but you're not there. You're just kind of coasting, you know, you're not really yourself. And I was again, you know, like, shut up, like, I'm fine. Like, it's all in your head. Like, I'm absolutely fine. And just wasn't there. And then what basically brought it all to the surface was her going, look, like, something's like, you're not all right. Like, we're not all right. And then she broke up with me. And then that, you know, was kind of like, I guess, my crutch gone. And I was like, whoa, I'm on my own. And so broke down, like went for a week of just crying, like saying horrendous things, like just complete and utter just disbelief what was going on, and had no idea what I was doing. So the only way I knew I could get out of it was going home and telling my mom everything. So that's exactly what I did. I went home on the Saturday, on the weekend, and basically got in the car with my mom and just told her everything. And literally from that day, everything's been better. You know, I'm not saying 100% straight away, but it was a relief. It was like, right, someone knows, like, I've told someone. You know what mums are like. Straight away, she got on the phone, found a therapist. She was like, right, if you want to talk to this guy, like, you can get to know him if he's good. And yeah, and I spoke to him twice a week for the first month, and then spoke to him on a weekly basis for a couple of months. And that was single-handedly the best thing I ever did. I mean, you can look back at all the events and, you know, I wish I acted on it sooner, but the best thing which happened was my ex-girlfriend, in a horrible way, she went through a hell of a lot, was ending it with me, because that was the only thing which kicked me in the face and went, you're like, shit, I'm not all right. Like, I need to get help. Otherwise I could see myself just carry on going in a direction which wasn't healthy. And then it was until someone, you know, actually gave me a kick up the ass and said, like, no. And I was like, I'm on my own here, but I had to go tell my mom and people I cared about, you know, my friends and stuff like that. And that was the best thing which ever happened to me in terms of getting me myself right again. And, you know, I'm fully aware that I've gone through a lot and I'm not 100%, but I'm a million times better than I was in end of November, let's say that. And like, I'm I've never been happier. And the best thing I did was talking to a therapist and attending people. And that's kind of the main message, which I'm really passionate about now, especially in rugby and sport, is getting that across. And if my story helps people, then that's kind of my main goal now, is to do that.
It's an incredible, powerful story, Tom. And I was going to kind of touch on your last point to begin with, and then and go back, if you don't mind, just going through what you just said there. And you said there, if my story can help someone, that would mean a lot to me as well. Is that maybe part of the reason why you've decided to do sort of the interview with the Telegraph and speak to Will? I know you know Will anyway, but yeah, was that kind of the reason, and maybe coming on the pod today and having a chat with us?
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, so the interview I did with Will was actually like, that was beginning of November I did that. I'm going through a lot of it then, so I probably didn't open up to him as much as I would have if we did it in January, let's say that. But again, that story kind of, it definitely got out there, and a lot of people messaged me saying, you know, like, fair play and all that. But then before that, Dan Schofield from the Telegraph got in touch with me, just asked maybe to do an interview about the my transition, not knowing obviously anything going on. And I said no at the time. I was like, no, I know what, I don't want to do it. I just talk about stuff, and again, probably just didn't want to talk about actually how I felt, and maybe something might come to the surface, which I didn't want. But then everything happened over Christmas, over November, and you know what? And then I was like, you know what? Actually, and as I started to get a lot better place, I messaged him. I was like, you know what? If you want to do this article, I'd love to do something, but maybe not about my transition, just more about kind of what I've been through. And I didn't explain much, but I was like, you know what? I think it'd be an important story to get out there. So then we sat down kind of beginning of January time and did it all, and it went out kind of end of January. And the reaction from that, I was obviously very nervous about putting that out there, because it's a very personal story and obviously involves other people as well who went through a lot, so for them it's not nice. But I kind of thought, you know what, I need to do it. Just one, it'll help me, and two, hopefully it'll help other people as well. And as soon as it went out, I was like, yeah, that was the right thing to do. The reaction it had, people kept going to me like 2 days after, or the day off it went out, you must be so proud. But I was like, you know what, I'm not proud, I'm just petrified right now, just kind of waiting to hit, like, see if it was the right thing to do. And then after that, I was like, yeah, I am proud. I had loads of people messaging me saying how much it helped them and stuff like that. I had, you know, mums messaging me about their sons who've gone through similar things and never agreed to see a therapist, but after reading my article have agreed to see a therapist. Wow. So stuff like that, like, it just straight away was like, you know, that was a definite right thing to do, and I'm happy I've done it, and I want to do more now. So yeah, that was kind of the idea behind it, and hopefully, yeah, that's what's happened.
Interesting, Tom. You and I had a chat last week for probably half an hour, yeah, which was really good. It was like two old mates just having a chat, and actually, you tell your story in a brilliantly humble way, and all credit to you.
Thanks, appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I said it to you last week, but if you asked me to talk like this 3 or 4 months ago, I would have absolutely not. You wouldn't have got much out of me. But just realizing how much good it does and how much it helps me, like, as selfish as it sounds, it helps me lots talking about it. So if it's helping me and helping other people at the same time, to me, it's a no-brainer. And the more honest I can be, the more it helps people. So, I mean, I could easily tell my story and hide behind a few things and maybe not tell the truth and still get a powerful message out. But the more honest you are, the more hopefully it will help people.
And Mar mentions there, Tom, about sort of you're very humble when you tell your story. But if you do kind of look back at the success you experienced as you're still young, Tom, but you know what I mean, like a younger player, you know, you were part of the Northampton Saints team, which create history. You know, they won the double. You're winning under 20 world championships, you're winning under 26 nations with England, and it kind of feels from the outside looking in that you only kind of experienced success. And did you maybe think at that point, well, I've made it, this is my career now, I'm winning stuff, I'm an extremely talented player, people are talking about me, this is fantastic?
Yeah, I mean, to an extent, yeah. I mean, I never deep down thought I made it, because I hadn't played for England or anything yet, or never had. So I never thought I'd made it, but I thought it was easy. I maybe got in a space with my first 2 years, or like you said, all I experienced was success. So I maybe thought it was a bit easier than it was. And, you know, we won the Premiership, Hamlin Cup in the same season, and I played, you know, 20 plus games that season. So I was like, well, you know, this is quite a nice life, this. I experienced in 2 years what people sometimes don't experience in a whole career. So I probably got a bit too much success early on looking back on it. And But again, like, it was after those 2 years, it was then I had no kind of realistic looking at it, I had nothing that negative happen to me in my whole life as such. Like, everything I kind of wanted to do, I kind of achieved. And then all of a sudden I had something which was out of my hands, an injury, which I had no control over, do that, I take it out. And the first injury I had was Liz Frank against Racing Metro. And I was out for like 8 months of that. And that period, I was like, right, this is, like, in my head, I was like, this is the moment where I'm being tested. Let's grab it with two hands and just go for it. Like, so I got an unbelievable nick. I hit the gym hard. I was like, right, we're coming back and we're doing stuff here. Like, we're getting in a place where we're going to absolutely smash next season. Like, this season's a write-off. Let's forget about it next season. And then it was the kind of, I got back really good shape. First game in pre-season, Rotherham at Franklin's Gardens, broke my leg in four places. And that was like the bit where it really took the wind out of my sail kind of thing. I was like, shit. And I didn't think about it. I just quickly, like, 3 weeks at home, got back to the club. I was like, right, let's go again. But I never took time to really sit back and look at what I'd been through and kind of maybe go concentrate my mental health rather than just get straight back into it. And let's go again. Let's go hard. I just burnt myself out completely and end up resorting to taking quite a lot of, drinking a lot on the weekend and stuff like that. And just being an idiot and trying to get my excitement and thrills from other places other than the rugby pitch, which I couldn't do. And trying to get my attention, which I had all my life, which I was always seeing as the rugby player, whatever. I wanted attention in another way. Like, I needed that attention. That was like I was seeking it constantly, and just didn't matter how it came. I just wanted it.
When you have an injury like that, obviously, kind of, you know, you get the doctors and the physios involved, and there's a kind of a lot of support in terms of getting you back fit and healthy and ultimately on the pitch. Is there anyone there kind of looking at the mental side of that and how you deal with it and checking in on you and supporting you?
Yeah. In 100% honesty, back then, not much. There was a time, actually, I remember kind of towards the end of my injury where I broke down at the club a little bit and had a cry. And then the physios I came up to was like, do you need some help? And me being young and in a rugby environment, just went no, I'm actually fine. I'm just really tired, like, absolutely fine. But no, there wasn't actually like a therapist. I think now there is starting to, I know in my last couple of years at Irish there was, but the whole issue which I talk about a lot now is, for me, which, because when you're in it, when you're in that environment, it's very hard when you're going through tough times, it's very hard to come out and talk and open up and tell people you're not doing well. Also, most of the people who are in those stages, I don't know they're in those stages. They just think they're going through a tough time. They don't know they're actually really struggling with mental health and stuff like that. So for me, it's the education at early age, and I think academy boys, it should be compulsory for them to see someone, just talk. Like, I think for me, if I sit down with a therapist who's fully qualified and professional therapist, and he was talking to me, I might have brought some stuff to the surface which I didn't even realize. Just by talking, and that's the main thing. Like, him asking me questions, or she asking me questions, I might just unravel, and then all of a sudden you realize, shit, I'm not in a good place here. I think a lot of boys would have that if they spoke to a therapist, especially being through tough times. Because my biggest lesson from it always, doesn't matter if you're not, it doesn't matter how big it is at the time, doesn't mean in 5 years' time it's not going to get bigger. So deal with it when it's at a small stage, rather than letting it grow and grow. Because it always, I mean, from what I've spoke to people and learned over the last couple of months, it always tends to get bigger. It doesn't matter like where it starts off at. It doesn't mean in 10 years' time it's going to be an absolute, you know, could be an absolute car crash, like a bit like myself. But I'm very fortunate that it happened at age 26, not 36. Which, if it happened, you know, when I was 35, 36, it would have been a lot harder and a lot more difficult. So I'm very happy that I'm happy I finished age 26 rather than, yeah, because it all came to service then.
Just coming back to the failure part of things that you were talking about, do you reckon that, I mean, this is a bit of a tough question, but do you reckon all the success that you achieved and the lack of failure you experienced led to the problems further down the line, in that, so you perhaps said that, you know, rugby was easy and perhaps when you first experienced that negative parts of the injuries, do you reckon that led to the problems further down the line? And then, I guess, second part of the question is it important to experience both success and failure from a young age?
Yeah, the second part, 100% agree with it, is very important. I probably didn't experience enough failure. But in terms of did it affect, it definitely didn't help. Let's put it that way. It definitely didn't help. But I think what I went through with the injuries, the whole issue of it was bottling it up. That was full stop. I was bottling everything up, and it was just an explosion waiting to happen. It's a tough question to answer because I don't know. But I could definitely say it definitely wouldn't have helped. I think experiencing failure in any asset of life, in any aspect, whether it's love life or what, relationship or sport or working life, any failure is good. As long as you come back from it and I probably didn't experience enough at a young age, so I probably was a bit arrogant and fully thought I was killing life, and which I was far from. And that's probably the perception when I got injured I was trying to give off to people, that I was still doing well, I was still having a great time, and I was still happy, when deep down I really wasn't. I probably just tried to continue that lifestyle, and I was too stubborn and arrogant to admit I wasn't doing well, which is the hard part, which I look back on now and think, God, it sounds so stupid saying it, but it was true. That I was just too cared about other people's perception of me to actually open up. That was the hard bit for me.
Was that maybe why, Tom, you felt you couldn't potentially lean on someone else to help you through that difficult time, because you were more worried about what other people would think of you?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I mean, I was like we said, 18, 19, I was Tom Stevenson in front of all my mates. Tom Stevenson, the rugby player, everyone was at uni, in debt. I was earning good money, supposedly having a great time playing in front of 80,000 people at Twickenham, living people's dreams. And, I probably didn't want people to suddenly think maybe he's not doing too well. I wanted to keep up that perception that I was doing really well, and that, I could do whatever I wanted, kind of thing. Very deep down, I got to the point where I used to hate going back to my old school, because I was obviously, when I was 18, 19, they were like, I was the big thing. I was, but then when I was 20, 23, and no one heard my name in 2 years, I didn't want to go back because people might ask me, what are you doing? I didn't want to go back. I was so caught up in what I was and couldn't come to the realization, right, I've got to start again, kind of thing. That was the hard part for me. It was just caring what people thought about me so much. Whereas now, the biggest thing I've learned over the last 3 months is only caring about people, my family and my best mates, and people who actually matter to me, rather than some guy I'm going to see once a year at a party. Whether he thinks I'm doing well and got lots of money and doing well in life, does it matter? No. But back then I did think that. So that was me, but that was part of my reason I didn't want to tell anyone.
And with that, Tom, does that maybe filter into kind of this isolation, that isolated feel that you may have had, because you're worrying so much about what one guy who you may not see again is thinking about you? You may have shut yourself off from that support network, like your mates, like your family, like you mentioned there.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to my mum a lot over the last 3 months, even my dad a lot. When I was growing up, I was the biggest mummy's boy in the world. You couldn't get me, everything. I always wanted to cuddle and stuff like that. And then kind of as those days, we didn't ever drift apart, but in terms of actually talking, I drifted apart. She always asked me how I was, and I would just do the same thing I did with my ex-girlfriend. She'd say, like you get angry, yeah, I'm fine. What are you on about? Leave me alone. Stop asking if I'm all right. I'm fine. And she said to me, she felt like she was treading on glass every time she spoke to me. Mm-hmm. It was always, trying to ask me if I'm right, but I would get angry with her. So she was like, God, what do I do? 100%, it affected a lot of relationships. And I look back on now, and the guy I was going out every weekend, people didn't like him. People going out and being an idiot, people didn't like him. But it wasn't me. I was just trying to give a perception of myself, which I thought people wanted to see, or I wanted people to see. But it wasn't, people didn't like him. I know for a fact, people didn't like him, looking on the outside. I look back at him and think, what a prat, he was an idiot, but it was good, probably good fun to the right people, but he was an idiot otherwise. Yeah.
One thing I thought when I read the article is that there must be injured players out there that are going through maybe not to the extent of what you went through, but similar sort of stuff right now. Have you sort of looked at that and when people get injured that you know, do you check in on them? Do you make sure that they're getting on okay?
Yeah, so something like I've been quite conscious of, so for example, that Jack Willis injury on the weekend, like I almost had a tear in my eye as soon as it happened, because I was thinking, fuck, I don't know him personally, Jack, at all, but I know what he's been through in terms of, like, he obviously had a horrible knee injury a couple of years ago and then worked his ass off to get back to where he is now. Like, that's tough going in itself. Like, and then now for him to, you know, score a great try, and then 5 minutes later to do what he did, I'm like, literally, I was like, oh my God. So like, I want to reach out to him. Like, I was waiting for the right time, like stuff like that. I'm like, that must be horrendous. Like, and like, I don't know. I know he's pretty tough character, but even the toughest characters will get affected by that. So it's just like, you know, people around him need to, like, you know, really get behind him. And I look at my mates now, like, still playing, and I know I can probably just from the outside tell, and I can probably tell that some of the ones who are going to go through, it sounds bad, but you can just kind of see it now because I've been through it. Like, I was like, it's a bit of a facade they're putting on. So those boys, yeah, I have reached out to.
Is there a bit of a risk that kind of almost subconsciously rugby breeds issues like this, in that kind of you're taught to put on a front and you're media trained and, you know, you come off the pitch after getting battered and you've got to put on a positive spin and kind of have your face on the whole time, and maybe it becomes hard to transition to actually opening up and being honest?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because rugby obviously is awesome in so many ways for mental health in terms of getting out there and, you know, physical and stuff like that. But at the same time, I think especially in a professional environment, you're having this constant battle of being hard and relentless and, you know, being on the pitch, tough guy. Then as soon as you come off it, it's like a lot of people still feel they have to keep that up. And there is probably a bad kind of culture in rugby to have that, which is, I think it is getting better. Don't get me wrong. I think it is definitely getting better. Some of the new kind of era, like the coaches around, they're kind of bringing in a bit more softer approach. Well, not even softer, it's just a much more smarter approach, rather than constantly having to be the toughest guy in the room, which is just nonsense. Like, for me now, I feel like I'm so much more of a tougher bloke for speaking about stuff like this, rather than being that guy who's not himself. And I didn't know who myself was by going out and getting smashed and, you know, jumping in a bin like I used to. Like, and look back now, I think like I'm 10 times the person I was for doing it. So like, and I look back at some of the people who, you know, some people are naturally alpha males and that's their role. That is who they are. So it's fine. But it's when you put the pressure on other people to be like that. Like, it should be an open floor. Like, if someone's got something, if someone's had a really shit week, they should be able to go, you know what, go talk to someone. Like, you know, be feel comfortable and happy enough to just start open up about it, rather than feeling, oh, I'm gonna get judged by this. So yeah, I think you're 100% right, but hopefully it is getting better. And there's some stuff I want to do as well. It is by going into clubs and talking about it and making people more aware of it, especially the senior people. When I was younger, whatever the senior guys in the club would do, I would do. So if they're leading by example, then yeah.
Yeah, and just listening to you, Tom, there, it seems like you place a lot of importance on having that first conversation and opening up to it. In your case, it was your mum, and I know from first-hand experiences, that first conversation has been a difficult one, but in the long term, it does work out, and you do feel 100 times better, as you said before. So looking back on that now, how much of a turning point was that for you, and why did you not feel you could even tell your mum about potentially what you were going through at the time?
Yeah. So I suppose why we wouldn't tell my mum is because I didn't want to tell myself. I didn't believe it myself. The sad thing is, I think once you get to a certain stage in a kind of mental health battle, it kind of takes you to hit rock bottom. I think the time to tell my mum would have been 5 years ago. But then, because it was living with me for that amount of time, I dug away and I just buried it and didn't want to believe it myself. So that's why, like, it's almost like, I don't want to compare it to a disease, but it is almost like a disease. Like, the earlier you catch it, the better. You know, the longer you leave it, the worse it gets, and the harder it is to treat. So it took me to, like, really, you know, for my ex-girlfriend leaving me, for me to all, like, actually open up and tell my mum. And my mum's the most open and honest person. Like, she, like, it's not the scary person to go talk to about. It was just, I was so scared of letting, I've in my head, like, she sees me as nothing going wrong with my life. Like, she sees me as a, you know, like a rugby player and a tough guy, and, you know, she's the one I don't have to worry about, kind of thing. So yeah, it's going back to that. Like, I was in such a bad place mentally that I couldn't even tell my own mum that I was struggling, which now I look back on it and think, what, like, it's just like, yeah, it just doesn't make sense to me now. But at the time, I wouldn't catch me talking about feelings at all. Yeah, it's amazing that I even got a girlfriend. But yeah, like, yeah, it was how I was. And what was your other question there?
It was just basically to say how important it is to have that first conversation. And you were talking there about going into clubs and speaking to these guys. And I guess that's probably the ethos of the message you would probably get across.
Yeah, exactly. And like, for me, that's the reason I think I want to do it, is because I used to play professional rugby like they do. Mm. And like, if they hear my first-hand experience, and they'll probably look at that, probably a lot of them will go, I can really relate to that. So that might, you know, trigger something in their mind to go, you know, maybe I should talk. And they might even want to talk to me about it. Like, I've had a lot of people kind of, because I've been through it and I'm quite open about it and honest, they probably feel a bit more inclined to tell me about it rather than someone in the club who might, you know, who in their head they'll think it will judge them, but they won't. It's like, that's the thing I've learned. No one judges you for it. And if they do, it's their issue.
Yeah, I think the guys at Looseheads probably resonate with that very well, Tom, in terms of that they will probably get messages. I know some of their ambassadors have got on board, get messages, and they feel comfortable talking to people about those experiences because the people they're messaging have gone through as well. So I think you're absolutely right there, Tom, with what you say. And also, when I was reading the stuff you did with Will last year, Tom, you talked about maybe like life after the rugby as well. And in a weird kind of way, has your situation maybe highlighted the importance of that and planning for when you finish playing as well, for any of the young players that might be listening or might, you know, see your story?
Yeah. I mean, I was the worst case study for getting ready for life after rugby. I never did a single day's work experience in my life, didn't do a degree, didn't do anything like that. And yeah, probably a good case study for it to do work, because look what happened. But for me, like, in rugby, you've got so much spare time, but it's hard to tell someone to go and do work experience until they get to my stage and experience that. It's hard to, because it's really up to them to do it. But for me, like there is a huge emphasis on rugby players to do work experience. RPA are great for that. They're awesome for getting boys into wherever they want to go, kind of thing. And giving them that opportunity. The opportunity is there. It's up to boys to grab it and do it. But one thing I think needs to be more emphasis on is for boys to be mentally ready to stop rugby, because you are going from such a different environment, work sense and every day, but you're also losing an identity. And like, are you fully prepared to, you know, for what's going to, it's not going to be easy. Like, are they ready for that? Because in my head, I was like, let's just get a job. Like, you know, every single person in the world just goes and gets a job. I can do it. But like, it's going from what I've been doing, being a rugby player, getting a lot of attention, a lot of people care about you. Suddenly you're out of the rugby club. No one gives a shit. Like, really, like, I came in some here and like, they were like, after a month, they're like, look, like, stop talking about rugby. Like, I was like, okay, yeah, cool. We don't care about rugby anymore. Like, it's like, right, I'm done there. You know what I mean? Like, no one gives a crap. Like, so it's getting ready for that and actually being ready to that transition mentally. As well as obviously the main thing is being prepared work-wise and knowing what you want to do, kind of thing. But I think if any advice for rugby players looking to finish is, you just be prepared to kiss a lot of kind of frogs or toes, whatever the saying is, before you find your right career. You're not gonna, your first job out of rugby isn't necessarily gonna be the one you're gonna stick with for the rest of your life. So don't be scared about that.
Because one of the things that struck with me, Tom, when you were speaking about it, was you kind of said, well, I actually had to look at myself and believe in myself because I've got all these skills. And it was about, as you say there, maybe just leaving the rugby to one, parking the rugby to one side for a bit, but then focusing on what's good about you. And I guess that's something players will want to try and learn from and take into the real world, if you like.
Yeah, that is one thing I spoke about Will about, which is huge. Like in rugby, you learn so many skills which are transferable to the work world. So many, like just stupid ones, like talking to sponsors after a game and having that interaction, that sociability, like, which so many people I realize coming into the office don't have. Like, people don't know how to talk. Like, it's like, what? Like, we did that for basically after, like, for an hour after the game, talk to people we don't necessarily want to talk to, but you do. stuff like that, as well as, you know, leadership skills, like resilience. You're automatically competitive, or as you wouldn't be playing professional sport. And like, you've got a great example of being competitive. People come into interviews the whole time and say, "Oh, I'm competitive." "Oh, are you?" "Yeah." "Well, like, why are you competitive?" They don't know. But I used to play professional rugby. Like, obviously I'm competitive. Like, every week we used to train our asses off for the weekend. And then if we lost, I wouldn't like sleep that night, you know. That's being competitive. So you've got so many like transferable skills, which you just need to zone into. I mean, in your interview process, whatever you're going for, really click into them, like, and forget about all your negatives. Like, if they're looking for you to be the finished article, they're not, you know, you're not the right thing. But if they're looking for someone to come in and give it their rule and have the right qualities, characteristics, then you are the right person and you will learn. Like, that's what you're going to get across, or should I learn, which was the main thing for me. And when I went to interviews and I was vulnerable, I said to them, you know, I don't have a first Scooby about this industry, but what I do have, I have all this, and I will put all that into this, and together, hopefully I'll be a good asset to your company. And that's like the main thing I learned from it all.
Yeah, and just on sort of one thing you mentioned as well there before, Tom, about the RPA and the role they do in kind of helping players and get that work experience and take maybe that next step away from the game. But, you know, are organisations like the RPA and Looseheads as well, sort of the support players and people needed, they are struggling at the moment because they are so positive and do great work for the game. Yeah. And they're continuing to be more prominent than ever. So, you know, if Looseheads continue the great work doing, the RPA continue to work well, it's only going to benefit players who may be in similar situations to what you've experienced.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. It's, for me now, like, it's all about getting the awareness out there. And the more you can shove it in people's faces, the more they're going to like log it, like click into it and actually like look into it. But the main thing which I find is up to the players to take advantage of those services. The RPA, the Looseheads, you know, there's so many like services out there which want to help, but it's now the clubs. I think a lot of it is on the clubs as well. Like, players, you know, are led by the clubs. It's up to the clubs to reach out to the Looseheads and RPA and say, look, you know what, you know, there is a bit of issue about mental health in rugby. Let's work together and get something like going and put some structure in place. Whether it's grassroots to professional. For me now, it's like, I think the clubs have got a huge responsibility to look after their players at the end of the day. And I spoke to a few clubs when the article came out, and I said, imagine how powerful it is if you've got a team talking about your feelings. And when they're going out on the pitch, they know the guy next to him about his struggles. And it's not just how amazing the player is, but his struggles. Like, imagine how powerful that is for a team culture. Like, rather than bottling everything up and not knowing the first thing about the guy next to you. Like, if he knows your deepest, darkest issues, like, Jesus, how powerful is that? Like, I think that's going to be a pretty successful team. With a bit of money as well.
Because that support as well, Tom, that you just mentioned there, just finally on this, is it's great to see, because you tell your story, but then you get former teammates of yours and people who are in the public eye tweeting you and saying, brilliant article, Tom, you're going to help so many people. And I know, like, you know, Dylan Harley was a great support to you and all these other guys. And again, people will look at your story and go, I'll take inspiration from that. But they may take inspiration from some of the comments as well.
Some of the players who reach out to me, like I had like a message from like Matthew Tate, who I'd never met before, but obviously an awesome player, and people like that, just saying a great article. It's like if you've got ex-England players, England internationals, like relating to it, like saying they relate to it, like those academy boys, 19, 18, who no one's ever heard of, but in, you know, 4 years' time, they might be playing for England. If they're seeing people like Dylan Hartley and Owen Farrell talking about their, you know, emotions and feelings, and not coming across like the hardest man in the world, and nothing's ever affected them, then they may be like, you know what, actually it's all right to talk about the softer stuff in life and not have a facade that everything's all right and that you are the hardest bloke in the world and you know, whatever comes at you, you're just gonna whack it out of the way, and nothing will ever touch you kind of attitude. So that for me is really important. And the more kind of publicity it gets, then the better, and the more bigger names get involved, and yeah, it is obviously like everything, it grows. The bigger names you have on it, the more people get involved in it, and it's just a snowball effect.
One thing I wanted to ask you, Tom, and I know the answer to it already, but there's people out there listening to this who potentially are struggling in silence. Are you glad? I know that you said that you wish you'd done it earlier, but are you glad that you shared your story? And are you glad that you spoke to your mum, and are you glad that you had that article that came out?
Yeah, I'm probably a bit pissed off, if I'm honest, that I didn't do it sooner. I had the opportunity to do it in August when, you know, Xmas was telling me to go see someone, but I said no, and I was just that denial. But am I happy as happened? Like, I'm so happy. Like in terms of personal and selfish point of view, like, I'm in the best headspace I've ever been, ever been in. Like, I can't remember the last time I felt good, because it was like 5-6 years ago playing in the Premiership, but even that was like fake. It was just happy because I was winning and looking good and, you know, and all that kind of thing. But now I generally feel content in myself, and just happy. I kind of more just gives you some sort of clarity in terms of what I want from life, what's important in life and stuff like that. I'm just annoyed I didn't do it sooner. And it probably affected a few things on the way. And like my mum's relationship, you know, stuff like that, even, you know, the ex relationship, like ruined stuff like that. It's just like, it's just annoying that it didn't happen sooner, but you can't look at stuff like that. You just got to look at now and yeah, I'm happy as can be. I hope it comes across that I'm pretty passionate about doing more stuff like this to help others, maybe so they can catch it sooner and not kind of go through the things I went through to suddenly realize they're in a bad place.
Hi guys, I'm Sam James. I'm a Loose Heads ambassador, and you're listening to the Loose Heads podcast. Make your mental health a priority.
It would be unfair of me not to ask you about your playing days and some of that success that you did have that we touched on at the start, because it's quite the CV, you know, with England under 20s and Northampton, and just looking back at that under 20s team that you were involved with, Tom, some of those names are just, you know, box office names now. And you mentioned bigger names before, but, you know, your Henry Slade, Anthony Watson, Mario Itoje stuff. What was it like playing with those guys and sort of experience that success with the national side in those couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's weird, I guess, because I obviously know them from like 18 and like they weren't box office names then. And then seeing their journey just kind of keep going to where like Mario Itoje is now, like one of the best players in the world, probably one of the biggest names in rugby. It's bizarre, but like I think you never really thought about them playing for England back then. But looking back on it, it was pretty obvious they were going to go on to great things. Like especially like Mara, he was unbelievable. Like every tournament we played in, he got man of the tournament and all that. He was just different. Like always, like the Exeter boys are a great example to use. Like, you know, Henry Slade and Jack Noel and Luke Candicky, those boys, and Sam Hill. They just trained differently. Like they were just trained differently. Like they were just, I don't know what Exeter do down there, probably a huge reason they've been successful, but they used to come into the gym when we were 20s and go off their own section and do their own thing. It was just like they're training harder than us. Like they are training harder than us. They're just wired differently down there, I guess, and just very early age taught differently. But yeah, it's great to see that them playing for England and stuff like that and killing it. But yeah, like I was very fortunate in the age groups I played with. The 2 20-year-olds I played, we won both World Cups, and one in New Zealand, one in France. And both teams were ridiculous. Like, look at the players we had, especially that first one in France. We literally had, like, you know, Jack Clifford, who's sadly retired, Henry Slade, Jack Noel, Anthony Watson, Sam Hill, Luke Candicky, Carl Sinclair. The list goes on. Alex Hepburn from Exeter, like, unbelievable team. So it was no surprise that we won. We probably should have won it more comfortably looking back on it. But yeah. I was pretty fortunate in that.
And you mentioned sort of Marrow's rise there, Tom, and a lot's been made of him and sort of been a leader for England, a possible Lions captain. Is that something you think could happen because of the sort of the rise and the journeys, but on which you've been able to see?
He captained our 18 side, and I wouldn't say he was a natural leader back then, but he's definitely grown, and obviously that comes with the stature of the player he is. But what he had is the presence. Like he was, you know, like, he wasn't the type of captain who was going to shout and do all that. But on the pitch, everyone just followed him, obviously, because he was unbelievable what he was doing. And so I think the captain has many different roles, but one of them is definitely being respected. And I think he's definitely got that in abundance. So, I feel so far away from that kind of talk now, but I wouldn't bet against him being Lions captain or anything like that. But obviously, there's a few more names in that as well.
Yeah, just at club level as well, Tom, because we mentioned before, obviously, the Premiership and European success you had with Northampton Saints. I mean, if I'm right in saying, was that kind of your boyhood club as well? And was that like a dream come true for you to be part of that team?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I mean, I had season ticket age 5 and all that. So I used to go there with my dad every weekend, and I loved it. So I was actually at Wasps age 13 or 14. And then I played England 16s, and Northampton saw me playing, Dusty Hare. He saw me playing and was like, you know, like, we would love to get you down to Northampton. I was at Wasps at the time, but I was a bit like, you know what, I'm like, obvious, like, it was an absolute no-brainer. So yeah, I came down to Northampton age 16, and yeah. That was a dream come true, yeah, in all honesty. Playing at Frankie's Gardens every weekend was just like, and like half of my friends were there, like, just not because I was playing, but because they were going to watch Northampton. So it was, yeah, it was completely mad, and took it for granted completely, but like, it was mad. I loved that place.
Because I was going to say, it must have been a bit of a dream living right, and saying that season that you guys did go on and do the double, I think your first professional contract with the club was signed then. So again, that must have all just been such a brilliant experience for you that season. So then, you know, playing and making an appearance in both finals as well.
Yeah, that was pretty surreal. That's like, go back to all the success at once. And it was a bit like, you know, well, I suppose there's only one way for the career to go. It was mad. Like, I remember that weekend in the Premiership final at Twickenham. Like, had loads of my mates in the ground and like stuff like that. And like, when it was obviously went to the 100th minute, and obviously when he blew the whistle, like, I just remember, like, it was like, it was just the best feeling ever. And there's a picture like me, Alex Waller, like, and Dylan Hartley, like, hugging. And I just always look at that picture and just think, oh, it was amazing. I had to fly out to New Zealand for the World Cup the day after. So I always had a big night, and then classic mum, picked me up from Northampton and drove me to the airport. But I missed out on all the bus around Northampton and all that. So that was pretty heartbreaking. But I was on a flight to LA probably, and been going to New Zealand. But yeah, it was just a mad experience, to be honest. And like, something now at age 26, I'm not even that old, I can look back on and go, you know what, I had a great time. And you know, it doesn't matter how much money you earn in the city, you can never pay for experiences like that.
Yeah, not a bad sum of that, Tom, really. Winning the Premiership and having a World Cup winners medal around your neck from New Zealand.
Yeah, I mean, I'm starting to see why I got so arrogant now. It all makes sense. Yeah.
Well, not many rugby games come bigger than the Premiership final, and obviously playing for England under 20s as well, Tom. But it's now time for your Mars 15, which is becoming the biggest game in rugby very, very slowly. For this bit, Mark normally introduces this section of the podcast. So over to you, Mark.
I just wanted to, on behalf of all the mothers out there, Tom, and in particular your mother, say how brilliant it is that you came full circle and you've gone back and you now have that relationship with her.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, she'll be happy to get a shout out. I'm sure every boy would say that their mum is the most important woman in their life. And it was just a shame it took all this to realise I was taking it for granted and ruining that relationship. Not ruining, because I'd never ruin, she would never let that relationship be ruined. But I was not being the son I should be, let's say that.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Well, it's never too late, and I'm delighted for her and you. The premise of the Mars 15 is such that you pick a journey, and as you were talking, I'm thinking of, in a year or two or three, there might be some hapless player who plays for somewhere like Staines or Twickenham Rugby Club. They tip up at Rosslyn Park and they look across the centre and they think, who am I playing against today? And it's you. And they're thinking, what have I done to deserve this? And you just run rings around them. So, but the belief I have, and it did for me, is that when rugby bites you, it bites you very deep and doesn't let go. And we get absorbed into that rugby culture. So the premise of the Mars 15 is very simple. Mars have, the Martians have landed. They quite like the look of Earth, the rolling fields, the mountains, the streams, the oceans, and they quite like to take it over. So they've challenged Earth to a game of rugby to decide the future of our civilization. So not much riding on the game. We've lost the toss, sadly. So on Saturday, we depart for Mars, a game we have to win. Takes 4 weeks to get there, 4 weeks to get back. It's not all about rugby capabilities. It is about tourists and about all the big personalities. However, it is a game we have to win. So, Tom Stevenson, over to you, your Mars 15.
Well, I've gone for, hopefully, a good rugby side, but I've also tried to get some good tourists in there as well. So number one, I've got Corbs, Alex Corbacero. I lived with him for a year, and you know, he was very unfortunate with injury. He was the most professional bloke, and also when he got on the beers, he was pretty he could sink a few. Number two, I'll be getting a message from him if I didn't mention him, Hartley. And also everyone saw him probably as the England player, but he was king of the piss as well, so he could organise a social pretty well. And then it's big Scotty Wilson from Newcastle. He unfortunately had to retire from injury, neck injury, but played England 20s with him, and he's the biggest bloke I've ever seen, and the only guy to ever drink 15 pints and still be sober. So I don't know if Mars has got enough beer for him or whatever. Number four, this is more of a big name. I don't know him personally at all, so I don't know if he's good on the beers or not. But Eden Etzebeth, played against him when he played Toulon. So yeah, and he obviously just, I remember I ran into him and he absolutely manhandled me. Not that that's hard, but he's up there. And then another Northampton guy, Laws. At five, he doesn't drink though, so that was a question mark around him. He doesn't drink, he's a good guy. So get him in. Number six, Ross Moriarty, played with him on the England 18s before he went to the dark side, but and he's also a pretty loose guy. Number seven from the World Cup, Ardie Savea. He was obviously who he is, so it doesn't need much explaining. And Louis Picamole, when he was at Northampton.
Oh, yeah.
At eight, he was on, I would say, hands down, probably the best player I've ever played, especially that season. The season he had at Northampton, he was untouchable. Like, I remember at one game, he had like four people hanging off him and just still offloaded at the backhand. Like, just like, could stood there with like the people hanging off him. Number nine, purely for a tourist point of view, Lee Dixon. He was always the guy coming in the change room. He'd come out on the night out and sit around and have a good time, but he'd always come in the next day and be the first to ask about the stories. And he was living his life with the young lads, with his three kids and wife. So good tourist. Number 10, purely down to the name. I played against him when I injured my foot, Dan Carter, against Racing, his first game for Racing. He got mad in the match, even though he did nothing, but he still got mad in the match. So I don't know why he got that. Then number 12, this is a pure tourist, and he's a good player as well. My good mate Brendan Macken, Irish Leinster boy. He went for a lot of me when I was going through. You know, people talk about having sappuccinos, having a cappuccino and a sap. We used to have about 15 Guinnesses and a sappuccino. So he was there for me for that. Big George Peasy at 13, absolute legend of a bloke. He took me under his wing when I was at Northampton, and was an absolute legend, and could absolutely smash people as well. And Chesnam Colby on one wing, played him at 20s and was the silliest bloke I've ever seen alive. Like, I remember we watched the game live against USA when he played against them, and obviously I've never seen someone move as quick in my life. It was unbelievable. And we were like, who the heck is this guy? Like, how are we going to beat him? But yeah, he was unbelievable. Jack Nowell on the other wing, I spoke about him earlier. He's a bit of a freak, and just, I think he's just a really nice guy as well. And an unbelievable player. And then my other massive rugby crush at 15, who's Damon McKenzie. We played against him in the World Cup, and I was literally like, oh my God, I wanted to be him. I was literally like, I've never, someone my age, I want to be. I was literally like, he's unbelievable. And like some stuff he could do with a ball, it was like he had like an hour on the ball every time he got it. It was just so good to watch. So yeah, him at 15. And also we had a beer after the game in the nightclub, and he was a good lad. So yeah. Get him on the spaceship as well, wherever.
Quite an eclectic bunch, Tom. Who would be your captain?
It would have to be Dylan. Whatever he says goes. If he tells you to drink, you drink. But yeah. It's all you're going to think. You put a coach down. So I've got Stephen Myler as the coach.
Oh, he's nice choice.
Yeah, he's a big, massive rugby brain. And most composed bloke ever. So I basically just didn't like getting shouted at, so hopefully he wouldn't shout at me. And then I put team manager as myself back, but I'm talking about back in the days where I used to get really drunk and do silly stuff, because I could organize a good social then as well, so team manager can do that. So maybe put the mental health stuff aside and just get the social side of that guy. And he'll be a good team manager.
Well, for the first time in living history, a world first, you pick two men who were born and bred in Widnes, being Ross Moriarty and Stephen Myler.
Yeah, I knew Stephen was, I didn't know Ross was.
Yeah, highly brilliant.
I did that on purpose.
That's a brilliant team, Tom. Just quickly, Mark mentioned there about Roslyn Park. Are you looking to maybe play for them next season? We cover a lot of the national leagues on Talking Rugby Union. So
yeah, sure. Sorry, obviously COVID this year hasn't helped anything and nothing's been really going on. But hopefully, yeah, hopefully next season when it all comes back, hopefully, yeah, we'll get back down there. I probably need to put a bit more weight back on. I've been running quite a lot and lost quite a bit. So yeah, probably need to get back in the gym. But yeah, fingers crossed, obviously got a bit of time.
Great stuff. Well, all National One teams will be fearing going to the Rock more so than usual next season.
I don't think so. If they saw the size of me right now, they might be fancying their chances of running straight down my channel.
No, it's brilliant to hear you're going to be playing next season. Fingers crossed the National Leagues get started as well, Tom. But it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you on the Loose Heads podcast this afternoon and to go through your story and tell us a bit more about what you said in the interviews with both Will and with The Telegraph. Well, we really appreciate you being so open and honest, and thank you so much for your time, Tom.
Yeah, cool. Well, yeah, thank you very much for having me, like I said at the start. And yeah, I mean, it's something I'm very passionate about. So yeah, love what you guys are doing and look forward to doing some more stuff with you in the future. But yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
You're listening to the Loose Heads podcast.
Join the movement.
Let's get people talking about mental health.
And together we will tackle the stigma.
This
is the Loose Heads podcast.